is about simulating dynamical systems that are not Hamiltonian flows on a quantum computer. And before I go too much further, just in case you're disappointed, by quantum computer, I mean quantum computers as they currently exist, which of course is not much, to be honest. So what could you do with conventional ion trap quantum computers with half a dozen to a dozen qubits? Of course, you could do these things on a serious quantum computer, but the idea is to come up with some simple non-trivial problems that would be interesting to do right now. Let me acknowledge my collaborators on this. John Links is a faculty member at the University of Queensland in the Department of Mathematics. Two students, John Paul and Melissa, have both just finished their degrees. Melissa's gone to Oxford, and John Paul's gone to become an investment banker in London. Good luck to him. And Ross McKenzie, my collaborator in the physics department. So first of all, I want to discuss a little bit what I mean by a dynamical map. Most people, when they think of dynamics, think of Hamiltonians and flows, but I don't mean that. I mean something quite different. Then I want to talk about fixed points and bifurcations, just so we have a common language for some of the material in the talk. And then the two particular problems I'll look at in some detail, and I'll explain why they're interesting as we go along. One is something I'm referring to as the Jahn-Teller unitary map, and it's connected to a very important problem in biology, the process by which light is converted into biological signals in the eye. And the other is the transverse field Ising unitary map. The underlying Hamiltonian version of this is, of course, a textbook example of a quantum phase transition. So let me begin by trying to explain what I mean by a dynamical map. And the story goes back to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, when to celebrate, I think, the 60th birthday of King Oscar II of Sweden, a mathematical competition was organized. There were obviously very different times. One can't imagine, some president's birthday being celebrated by calling for a mathematical competition. It'd be nice to think it would happen today, but perhaps not. In any case, Poincaré, well, one of the problems that were posed, probably by Weierstrass, I'm not 100% sure, was the stability of the solar system, or if you like, the three-body problem in its simplest form. And Poincaré entered this competition and submitted an essay which actually won the prize, although he certainly didn't solve the question of the stability of the solar system. What he did do was introduce a completely different way of tackling coupled systems of nonlinear differential equations. I'll come to that in a minute. He won the prize, then the article was to be prepared for publication in a journal, and one of the people preparing it for publication queried one of the results, and when Poincaré was asked to check, he realized he'd made a mistake and hadn't done things quite the way he should have done. So this was all getting very embarrassing by this point. After all, you don't want to embarrass the King of Sweden and give the prize to somebody for something that was mistaken. But of course it wasn't mistaken, it just wasn't complete. And Poincaré then fixed it up, but in the process discovered what we now know as chaos. And the paper he submitted with the correction had an extra 100 pages in it. It's nice to know that one can have such a long errata back in those days, but I don't think you get away with that now. What Poincaré discovered was both a new way of studying dynamics based on geometrical techniques. Instead of looking at solutions in particular, look at solutions in entire classes. And writing about this in an essay now collected in a book called Science and Method, he is quoted as saying, "It may happen that small differences in the initial conditions produce very great ones in the final phenomena. A small error in the former will produce an enormous error in the latter, and prediction becomes impossible, and we have the fortuitous phenomenon," which he means random, I suppose. So this is the very first hint of chaos in something as simple as the three-body problem. And Poincaré realized this without having a computer, of course. He couldn't do simulations and just press a button and watch all sorts of complicated things on the screen. He discovered it by introducing a method that went beyond the standard approach at the time based on perturbation theories, which nobody could get a handle on because of a problem of small denominators. They didn't converge. He used a geometrical method, and there's this nice quote from Ivars Petersen, who on his website MathTrek, describing this whole story of the competition for King Oscar, pointed out that in fact, there was nothing that Poincaré did that wasn't already in Newton's equations. He just decided to look at them in a completely different way and discovered along the way what no one else had seen implicit in those equations, and that is sensitive dependence on initial conditions, what we now call chaos. So here was basically the element of his trick. The idea is to introduce what's called a surface of section and to look at, instead of entire orbits in a high-dimensional phase space, to look at successive piercings of those orbits of some cross-section in the phase space, some lower-dimensional system. So here we have three dimensions, and we define the surface of section as a two-dimensional surface, and we look at successive piercings of the orbit on that surface. So instead of looking at a continuous time dynamical system, one in which there's a continuous map between time and where the velocity and momentum, the velocity and position of the particle is, to look at a discrete map from successive piercings of the screen. In general, of course, they do not need to be separated by equal times. I'll come to a case in a moment where they are. And what Poincaré realized is that you could say everything that needed to be said about the underlying dynamical flow by looking at the stability of this discrete map, by looking at fixed points, the stability of fixed points, how they change as some parameter, some interaction strength is changed in the underlying equations. And so, for example, the periodic orbit of the continuous dynamical system, one that just keeps coming back to the same point after every cutting of this cross-section, that will be stable if and only if the underlying dynamical system, the orbit of the underlying flow, is stable. Well, that's a huge subject now, the study of dynamical systems in terms of Poincaré sections. There's one particularly simple kind of system where there's a very natural Poincaré section, and that is systems which are periodically driven in time. So imagine we have some nonlinear pendulum where we're giving it a kick at fixed periods of time, like somebody on a swing being pushed, if you like. So then the natural thing is just to describe the system at successive periods defined by the period of the driving force. So the Hamiltonian has some fundamental period, big T, and then we define discrete states by the values of the position and momentum at integer multiples of the driving period. And this defines what's called a stroboscopic map. It's a particular example of a Poincaré section where you add time as another dimension, let the orbits wander out, and then look at successive piercings of that section mod 2 pi. So that's a very nonlinear function, that f, and all of the interesting aspects of the full continuum flow is implicit in that discrete map. So the sorts of dynamical systems I'm going to be talking about here are these discrete maps. The classical version of the quantum ones I'll be talking about are discrete maps of this kind. So they're dynamical systems in their own right, and we're going to try and simulate them directly. Why would you want to do that? Oh, but before I do that, let me just give an explicit example of the famous kicked rotor. So one way to think about this is to imagine a compass needle sitting on a pivot point, free to move in the XY plane, can have any angular momentum at all, and we put a couple of current-carrying coils on either side, and we pulse currents through those coils. So periodically there's a magnetic field in the plane of the compass needle, and depending on the angle it makes with that magnetic field, it'll get a little torque, which will sort of kick it, and then it'll spin around for a while till the next pulse comes along. So L squared on 2 represents its angular kinetic energy, and then there's this kicking going on, which I've just abstracted here as delta kicking. Obviously it can't be completely delta function in time, but let's just suppose that the width of the pulse kicking it is very short compared to the period between pulses. Then you write down the stroboscopic map as this discrete set of equations that tells you what happens from just after one kick to just after the next kick. And then the period one fixed points are the solution to these equations where the points don't change from one iteration to the next. One can easily see that the fixed points are for zero angular momentum and for theta equals zero and theta equals pi. The next thing one has to establish is what is the stability of those points. So for that, you take the map and you linearize around the fixed points. That is, you do a Taylor series expansion of that complicated function f, so it becomes a linear system. And you can look at the eigenvalues of that linear map, and depending on whether they're purely real or have some imaginary component, the system is either unstable or stable. So for example, at theta equals zero, the system is stable for particular values of the kicking strength k. And for theta equals pi, it's unstable. That is, if you push a little bit away from theta equals pi, it will continue to move further away. If it's stable, if you push a little bit away from theta equals zero, it'll continue to come back near theta equals zero from one iteration of the map to the next. Area preserving means that the system, because it's derived from an underlying Hamiltonian flow, still preserves area in the surface of section, and that's manifested by the fact that the eigenvalues of linearized dynamics, their product is unity equal to one. If this was a dynamical flow and you were looking at the eigenvalues, the sum of the eigenvalues would have to be zero. But this is a map, and the product of the eigenvalues has to be unity. Now, as you change the kicking strength, if you just go back and look at that, I said it's stable for k less than 4. What happens as you increase k? Well, it turns out there's an extremely rich series of fixed points and multiple period fixed points where it comes back onto itself after two iterations of the map. And these points can undergo a change of stability, and in fact, you get so-called chaotic orbits in this system, where the value of theta is just jumping randomly from one iteration to the next, and the angle of momentum is slowly diffusing away from L equals zero. So these systems are the prototype systems for understanding classical chaos, which is, of course, why Poincaré was able to see chaos in systems of the three-body problems under Newtonian gravitation. Now, of course, there's a simple quantum description of these systems as well. If there is some classical area-preserving map that iterates the system from one step to the next, in the quantum description, there'll be a unitary operator that takes the state from one time step to the next time step. And of course, to find the unitary operator is to define the map, and that's not a trivial exercise. You would have to solve the Schrodinger equation over one period of the driving to actually find that. But once you've got it, it's then relatively easy to study the dynamics by looking at the spectrum of that unitary operator and its eigenvalues. So in the case of the kicked rotor I just described, there's an example. Delta kick systems, it's very easy to write down the unitary operator because most of the time it's just free dynamics, L squared, and then there's a short sharp shock comes along where the free dynamics is frozen and just a kick acts, and then off it goes again. So these so-called delta kick systems are extreme case of periodically modulated Hamiltonian systems where it's relatively easy to write down the unitary map. Okay, so what I'm interested then is in simulating, unitary maps on a quantum computer. Now, there's been a great deal of discussion of simulating unitary flows. Let me just go back to here. There's been a lot of discussion of simulating Hamiltonian flows on a quantum computer by trying to take time steps very, very small and using Trotter product type formulas and turning them into unitary maps. That's not at all what I mean here. What I mean here is to simulate directly the unitary map as it's given. And because it's a map, it's much more suited to simulation on a quantum computer because a quantum computer is, in effect, a sequence of unitary operators applied at fixed intervals of time. Because they vary a lot from one time step to the next, so what we're actually asking for here is even simpler, just the same kind of unitary, or maybe a product of two unitaries iterated over and over again. So an example of this is the Grover map, which I'm not sure everyone is familiar with it in this form, so let me just go through it. This is a kicked-free particle. It's basically a particle which is completely free to move. No forces act upon it, except for every so many seconds or so many microseconds, a potential is quickly turned on and turned off, so it gets a kick. Some impulsive force acts upon it. So again, the unitary that describes the flow k map, the stroboscopic dynamics of the quantum system, is a product of a potential energy term describing the kick, e to the minus IVQ, and a kinetic energy term describing the free motion between kicks. And here's an example of the sort of potential that you might think about if you were trying to do a Grover map. It's this thing which is basically zero everywhere, except in some particular place where it's very deep. So the particle tends to fall in. So classically, if you had a distribution of particles all of zero energy sitting on the x-axis, they would gradually start to flow into the hole, and you get a big density appearing at q equals 2 in this particular case. Well, this day doesn't look much like Grover's map as we understand it for the search problem. But you can begin to see the connection if I tell you what happens in the case of the Hamiltonian flow version. So let's just suppose the Hamiltonian is just the kinetic energy term and the potential energy term, and it's on all the time. So now if I draw the velocity vector field in phase space, just calculate Hamilton's equations, which gives you the velocity and the momentum component and the position component in phase space, and just plot it, which is very easy to do in Mathematica. then you get these little arrows that look like this. So there you see a fixed point with the arrow pointing to it where it doesn't move at all. And around that there's some oscillatory motion corresponding to particles at the bottom of that deep well just oscillating around the equilibrium point. And then you get these other particles well away from that that are just behaving like free particles. If they have positive momentum, they're traveling this way, and if they have negative momentum, they're traveling that way. But you see what's going to happen along the axis. Some of the particles, if you had a density, a uniform density, on average with zero momentum, but completely unspecified in position, that density will begin to deform in such a way it will tend to become concentrated around that fixed point. And so if you were looking at the position probability of finding classical particles that start off uniform in position, but would gradually peak at the position of the fixed point in this problem. Well, you can connect it to Grover's problem just by an extreme discretization of position and momentum. Instead of taking this nice smooth potential, just take the potential that looks like this, zero everywhere except somewhere near the fixed point where it's equal to 2. And for the kinetic energy, we just say, well, it's not a quadratic, it's not p squared, but it is zero at p equals zero, and it's non-zero somewhere else. So if you do that, then in this very coarse-grained sense, the map becomes exactly what you would expect from the Grover map, where the marked state is now 2, and I've chosen the strength of the potential to be exactly a pi phase shift when that is applied. So in this sense, and then of course you typically start in the Grover case with a uniform superposition of all the states which here are in the position basis, and then you evolve it forward from there. So in this sense, the Grover map is an example of a dynamical system. Okay, so one could continue at this point and ask, well, if Grover's map is a dynamical system, are there some interesting unitary maps that might suggest new kinds of algorithms? And that might be an interesting direction to go, but it's not a direction I'm going to go in now, because I want to come back to this idea of trying to simulate physical systems. So the question I want to turn to now is, are there some interesting dynamical maps that we could do right now on a quantum computer that somebody would be interested in, that say Dave Winand or Rainer Blatt or Ray LaFlamme on his NMR quantum computer could do right now? So the first one I want to look at is perhaps a little bit surprising. This is a very important problem in biophysics. I almost said quantum biology, but I don't really want to go down that road. So basically, it's the very first step in vision, where in Rhodopsin, what happens, a photon comes into this molecule, which has one shape, and if it absorbs a photon in a very, very short time, it undergoes a change of its shape. So it goes from either being straight to crooked, or actually, as I've indicated here, from being something that's slightly kinked to straightened out. Now, it does that extremely fast. And in 200 femtoseconds, all those nuclei have to rearrange and all the electronic orbitals have to rearrange so that this thing goes from one particular configuration to the other. When it does that, it sets in train a chemical process in the surrounding protein cage that eventually leads to a signal going through to your brain. Now, it doesn't always happen. Sometimes it doesn't change and other times it does, but the percentage of times, the relative fraction of which way it goes is known from experiment. But despite years of study, it's still not clear exactly how it could possibly be this fast. Well, the prevailing theory is based on something called a conical intersection, and this is where the Yahn-Teller model comes in. So imagine a very simple system which just has two electronic states, and when the photon is absorbed, it goes from one to the other. And if we plot out the energy of each of these electronic states as a function of the nuclear coordinates, obviously, for that complicated molecule, that's going to be a very high-dimensional object. But let's just suppose only two key coordinates are involved, describing cis and trans conformations of the molecule. Then the energy surface of both electronic states will change depending on the conformation of the molecule, and we can plot out the ground state and the excited state as a function of these two coordinates, these conformational coordinates. And the consensus is that what is actually happening in this system is somewhere in that complicated potential surface, the two surfaces sort of come together and have an avoided crossing in two dimensions. So it's called a conical intersection because it should be an intersecting cone, but in fact it's split and the degeneracy is lifted, so there's a very, very tiny gap. And the theory is what actually happens is there's a quantum tunneling process across that conical intersection where you absorb a photon, go up to the top surface, quickly run down to the intersection, tunnel across, which is extremely fast, and then through some poorly understood process of decoherence, it decides to go 60% cis or 40% trans. Nobody really understands that. So this is the problem. So it seems about as far from a quantum computer or an ion trap that one could possibly imagine. But what I want to suggest is there's a minimal model that one can look at where you simply have two qubits and one harmonic oscillator, sorry, the other way around, one qubit and two harmonic oscillator coordinates. One qubit to have two electronic states and two oscillators for each of these conformational degrees of freedom. So if you think about that, you could well imagine building that in an ion trap, having one ion, not in a linear trap, but a pancake trap. So it's it has strong confinement in one direction and weaker confinement in the other two, and by directing laser pulses onto it. So this is the minimal Hamiltonian flow model that one could use to describe this system. So the first term there, delta sigma z, is just the bare splitting of the energy levels of the qubit, meant to describe the bare splitting of the energy levels in some molecule. Then there's the kinetic energy term of the 2 degrees of freedom of the particle. Then the potential, quadratic potential term. Then there's a coupling between the x coordinate of this two-dimensional oscillator and the sigma x, the x Pauli operator for the qubit, and likewise for the y coordinate of the two-dimensional oscillator and the Pauli operator sigma y. It's incredibly simple. In particular, what I'm interested in is doing a map. So let me just back up a little bit now to show you that this would be very easy to do on an ion trap, just in case people here haven't seen the very unlikely event that you haven't seen this before. The idea is to trap a single ion in three dimensions, which necessarily requires a time-dependent potential because of Laplace's equation, and having done that, to cool it down to its ground state that truly is described by quantum mechanics. And this has been achieved now for many, many years. And of course, as we all know, due to Serac and Zoller, this ion trap architecture is one of the leading candidates for simple quantum computers, and probably the leading one at the moment. In the actual two-level systems are electronic states inside each ion, and typically they're metastable levels that are connected by some sort of Raman process like this. Anyway, there's two levels, a ground state labeled 0 and an excited state labeled 1, and you can drive single qubit rotations by external laser pulses in this system on what's called the carrier frequency. So if you tune these two Raman beams exactly right, so their frequency difference exactly matches the frequency difference of the two-level system, you can drive transitions between the ground and excited state. So you can implement Hamiltonians like this, just a single qubit rotation, sigma x. But the key thing which enables you to do anything interesting in these ion traps is that you can couple together the internal electronic state and the vibrational degree of freedom. And there are many different ways of doing this. The way I'm going to describe here is based on conditional displacements or conditional forces, where the sign of the force depends on whether or not the qubit is in 0 or 1. So this was used many years ago by Chris Monroe and Dave Wineland to make a Schrodinger cat state of a single ion in a trap. That is a superposition of a single ion in the trap on the left and moving to the right, and on the right moving to the left. The basic idea is that the ion is in a state of harmonic potential and an additional linear potential, so a force. But that force depends, the sign of that force, or the slope of the linear potential, depends upon whether or not the ion is in the ground state or the excited state. So we can model that by simply putting on a term chi t q sigma z. Or we can, chi means we can turn it on and off at will by these external lasers. So we can turn on and off the coupling as we wish. We can have complicated time variation if we want. And in the two-dimensional case, we could easily have laser pulses running in two different directions. So with single qubit rotations plus these simple conditional displacements, we can implement any coupling between x and any of the components of the pseudo-spin angular momentum, the Pauli matrices. So we need to go to some sort of two-dimensional ion trap and have different laser pulses applied along the x-axis and along the y-axis. And it's easy to see that one could easily set up a unitary map by using laser pulses to turn on and off these conditional displacements. Basically, we're giving a little kick to the ion, a little impulsive momentum change, and the sign of that momentum of that force depends on whether the ion is in the ground or the excited state. So it would be relatively easy to implement a unitary map of this kind. So basically, most of the time it's just left alone. That's the H naught term. The ion is just oscillating in a quadratic potential, and it just sits in either one or the other state or superposition thereof. So it's free Hamiltonian for the internal degree of freedom is sigma z, and then there's the vibrational degree of freedom. But then we turn on these two kicks, one after the other. We could turn them on both at the same time, but for the purposes of this talk, let's just imagine they're done in a sequential way. So that's the unitary map that we'd like to simulate. So it seems very simple, but it has an extremely complex dynamics, in fact, even more complex than the Jahn-Teller flow model, the Hamiltonian, from which this has been derived, as we discovered this year. So the first thing you'd like to do is get some intuitive understanding of what's going to happen in this system. And the idea here is to try and make sure you understand the classical dynamics first, and having understood that, you can quickly draw conclusions about what you would expect for the quantum states of this system, including entanglement. So how do we get the underlying classical problem, or perhaps not the underlying one, but a classical problem corresponding to this, is you, instead of writing down the Heisenberg equations of motion for how the operators change, you define a map on the operators, that is the position and momentum of the particle, and the three components of the qubit, x, y, and z. And the map is defined just by a single application of the unitary operator from one time step to the next. Then we take average values of both sides, and this leads to some horribly complicated thing, where first-order moments are coupled to second-order moments, and second-order moments are coupled to third-order moments, and so it goes. But you just forget about that and factorize everything in sight, and then just pretend that the average of sigma of qx is a classical variable qx, and likewise for sigma. So the phase space here is a four-dimensional phase space for the oscillator, and now the qubit classical phase space is a sphere. Surprising that this is going to lead to anything at all, but in fact it works extremely well. You might say, but hang on a minute, there's no classical limit of a qubit. Well, as far as the dynamics goes, there is, as I'll show you. And then we define the classical map. We already know what the Heisenberg map is. We can take the average values of both sides, we factorize, and then we have this classical dynamical map now in this rather high-dimensional phase space. Oops, I've left out momentum in those expressions. It should be qx, px, qy, py, then the three components of the spin, which are constrained to lie on the surface of a sphere. So you begin, as Poincaré did, by looking for the fixed points of this, that is, those points which are left invariant by the map, and then you want to understand the stability. So there's a trivial fixed point, which in fact corresponds to the ground state of the uncoupled system, where Sz is minus a half, which quantum mechanically means the ion's in the ground state, and the oscillator's just sitting at the origin and doing nothing, no momentum, and located at the origin. That's for zero coupling. Now, as you increase lambda, that stays stable until some particular value of lambda sub b, which depends upon the parameters that define the dynamics between the kicks, and so it goes unstable. And it loses stability, and new fixed points are born out of that. And this keeps happening over and over again. So it was initially rather difficult to understand what was going on in this. The algebraic equations are a bit of a mess, but you can formulate it like this. So the fixed point would correspond to the simultaneous solution of these two equations, where the position and momentum have been folded into the A and the B in this expression. I should have put that in. But the key thing now is that they basically define two-dimensional surfaces in the phase space, and we want to look at the intersection of those surfaces as we change the coupling strength. So it begins to look something like this. The dash curve corresponds to the minus sign on those previous equations, and the solid curve is the plus sign. So on the left is lambda equals zero, where you see the only intersection is at the origin, and this is a projection onto qx and qy in the oscillator phase plane. But as you increase lambda, you see there's a crossing of these curves, and that means there's now a non-trivial intersection, which gives you the new fixed points. And that happens when the origin goes unstable, and these points split out of it. The fixed points always lie along, these first so-called pitchfork bifurcations always lie along the line qx equals qy and some relationship between position and momentum. But if you increase lambda further, it gets very, very complicated. You get more and more crossings, and these fixed points bifurcate again. And even more surprising is you get intersections that appear out of nowhere, and these are so-called saddle node bifurcations. Okay, so let me just spend a little bit of time getting this sorted out. You have no problem in noticing that the fixed point of a simple harmonic oscillator, let's take a Hamiltonian float, a simple harmonic oscillator. The fixed point is the origin in phase space, and that is stable. The ground state of a corresponding quantum problem is a stationary state. The same, it's left invariant under the unitary dynamics, just like the fixed point is under the classical symplectic flow in that case. And of course, we know there's a one-to-one correspondence between the ground state, centered on, which is, if you use any phase-based distribution, as I'll come to in a minute, centered on the origin, and the fixed point of the corresponding classical system. So it's been discovered over many years in nonlinear dynamics that it's always possible to associate quantum states to particular structures in the Hamiltonian phase space. Just like in the harmonic oscillator case. There's a fixed point at the origin, which is associated to the ground state of the Hamiltonian. And in more complicated systems, say you had a double well potential, where now there are two fixed points corresponding to each double well and an unstable one in the middle between the two wells. If you go ahead and look at the diagonalize that problem, which is a quartic oscillator, so it's done numerically, and you start looking at the quantum eigenstates, you find, again, there are stationary states, which you can show, and I'll show you how to do it in a minute, are localized on the fixed points. So there's always a way to associate eigenstates, stationary states of the quantum problem, to the fixed points of the classical problem. That's the first thing. Does that help you see a little bit more? Okay, perhaps it'll become a little bit clearer as I move on now. I've just been discussing the classical dynamics of this. What I've tried to suggest is there's a very rich structure to the fixed points and their stability as you turn up the strength of the coupling between the vibrational degree of freedom and the internal dynamics of the ion. That's all classical. What we'd like to do now is ask what happens quantum mechanically. So let's look at quantum states. Well, at lambda equals zero, there's no coupling between these things, and you ask, what is the ground state of this system? The ground state is, must correspond to, the oscillator sitting at the origin in the phase space and the qubit being at minus a half in zero in quantum information terms. Sigma z is equal to minus one in this case. So there's a fixed, I mean, it's unambiguous what we mean by ground state for the case lambda equals zero because we actually have a Hamiltonian. On the other hand, if you're asking for the eigenstates of a unitary operator, it's not so clear what you mean by ground state, because the eigenstates of a unitary operator lie on the unit circle, unitary operator. You could take the log of that and define a so-called quasi-energy, but that will only be defined mod 2 pi. So there's some ambiguity in continuing to think about a ground state in the case of the map. So we take a rather pragmatic approach, and this is what is done in the quantum chaos literature, is in the zero coupling case, there's no ambiguity about what we mean by the ground state. And the idea is to slowly turn on the coupling strength and follow that state as we do so. And there's quite a rigorous way in which that can be defined. There's a number of questions that one would ask about such a procedure, which I can come back to later if anyone is interested. So the idea now is to follow that ground state for zero coupling through to non-zero coupling. And the question we want to ask ourselves is, how does that state reflect the corresponding semi-classical bifurcations that I just described? Well, it turns out that you need some way to represent a quantum state in phase space, because quantum states live in Hilbert space, as you said, just rotating, in this case, by discrete steps in Hilbert space. Well, the standard way to do it would be to use a Wigner function, some quasi-probability that lives in phase space, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use something called the Husimi function. I'm first going to just trace out the qubit, and then calculate the Husimi function for the oscillator part. I could do something equivalent for the qubit part, a different kind of quasi-probability representation on the sphere using something called the atomic coherent states. But here I'll just use the so-called Bargmann representation, the semiclassical states of a single oscillator. I need two oscillators here because it has 2 degrees of freedom. And then just project out my state for non-zero coupling onto these Bargmann states. And then I have a phase space and a distribution which I can then plot the contours of in that phase space. So as here I was only looking at the section QX, QY, the cross-section on P equals zero plane, I'll do a similar thing for the so-called phase-based probability distribution. In particular, because it's a very high-dimensional object, we have to get the dimension down so we can see anything, I'm just going to look at it along the line of the fixed points. So initially, for zero coupling, the fixed point is at the origin, QX, QY. That will lose stability, and new fixed points will be born out of it, but along the line, QX equals QY. So I'll just evaluate the Husimi function, or this Bargmann representation, along that line with a similar constraint on the momentum for where the fixed points lie. And this is what you see. You see that as you increase lambda along this line, you see that the quantum state faithfully reflects the underlying bifurcation in the corresponding classical system. This is a very important lesson. It means there's a deep correspondence principle that one can make use of in trying to understand what's happening in the corresponding quantum eigenstates, this time of a map, by first understanding what happens in the classical map. And that's a guiding principle for this work. Yeah? Yeah, what I'm plotting here is a contour, some 1 over E contour of this Bargmann representation, the so-called Husimi function, which is a, in operational terms, what it really is, it's the probability distribution for simultaneous measurements of position and momentum. This is a particular section of that distribution along the line that contains the fixed points, where the distance along the horizontal axis tells you how far along that line you are, and the distance on the vertical axis is the strength of the coupling between the qubit and the vibrational degree of freedom. So initially we start off, the distribution is concentrated on the origin in phase space, which is a trivial fixed point which is stable when there's no coupling. It remains stable until some critical coupling strength, which is in the classical system is at 0.26, where we see the quantum state becomes delocalized and now has peaks sitting on the fixed points. And in this projection, we just see it split along the bifurcating fixed points. Now, I could continue this and see the second bifurcations and so on, but there are some technical difficulties, which are non-trivial, connected with following states across so-called avoided crossings, very, very narrow avoided crossings. And that's absolutely what you'd expect in a system with possibly chaotic dynamics like this. So I'll just stop here because I just want to illustrate the point. It addresses the question you raised directly, that by first understanding the classical map, you can get a pretty good idea of what's going on in the quantum map. Now the question is, what about entanglement in this system? Well, if you calculate the derivative of the entanglement with respect to the coupling strength, as you vary the coupling strength, you can either look at the von Neumann entropy of the qubit, reduced state, and you see it goes through a peak as you go through the bifurcation. Or you can, take out one oscillator and look at the other bits, or take out one qubit and look at the two oscillators, but it always has a peak roughly where the semiclassical bifurcation is. So this is another important lesson. One can get a good idea of what's happening to the entanglement in the system. In this case, entanglement between the oscillators and the qubit, and the entanglement between the oscillators themselves. And it's not too surprising if you think about it. If this quantum state is somehow or other becoming delocalized on phase space, spread across the phase space of both oscillators, QX lies along the line QX, QY, with a particular correlation between momentum, then that tells you it's entangled. It's a pure state after all, and it's highly correlated in its motions. So again, understanding the classical dynamics gives you a handle on what you would expect in a quantum case. Now that's very suggestive of a quantum phase transition, which is what I want to finish on. Are there any interesting many-body unitary maps with a quantum phase transition? Is there something we could do right now in an ion trap that would give us access to a many-body unitary map? Let me just quickly say what a quantum phase transition is. Basically, as you might expect, it's something like a phase transition that happens at zero temperature. So typically, you're interested in the structure of some quantum ground state and some parameter in the Hamiltonian is varied. It could be a coupling strength, it could be an external magnetic field, it could be lots of things, pressure, and so on. So you want to understand what happens to the structure of the ground state in the same way I've just described the structure of this particular eigenstate of the yarn filler mat as you change the coupling. And of course, this has been discussed at length by many people, some in this room, and the standard way to do it is to start with the Hamiltonian and look at the ground state of the Hamiltonian. But as I've said, I'm not so much interested in that. I want to look at a unitary map based on that. So there's the transverse field Ising model. It's actually very easy to set up a unitary map based on that in a few qubit ion trap quantum computer. It's just a composition of single qubit rotations followed by controlled phase gates between pairs of qubits. So this is very easy to do. So that's the iterated map I'm interested in this case. I stress I'm not considering, so this is a circuit diagram, if you like, showing how simple it is. Just a whole bunch of single qubit rotations followed by concatenated pairs of two qubit control phase gates, ZZ Ising type interactions, and then repeat over and over and over again. So I stress I'm not thinking of this as an approximation to the Hamiltonian flow. This is meant to be a dynamical system in its own right. I'm not going to take any small tau limit for time steps or any such thing. This is the dynamical system, this map. That's all I'm interested in. Now we know it's non-trivial because it's actually very hard to write this. I mean, it is a unitary operator, so in principle we should be able to back out some generator for it. But it turns out to be quite difficult to do this in general. For this particular case, I'll show you it can be done, and that's very important. So that Hamiltonian you do end up with in that case is certainly not the Hamiltonian of the transverse field Ising model. It'll be something else. And as I'll show, it's actually a rather complicated thing that has non-nearest neighbor interactions, but nonetheless belongs to the same universality class as the transverse field Ising model. So the way you do that, this is a technical bit which I'll just rush over. For those who know this stuff, this might help. For the others, just go to sleep at this point. You would do it by using the Jordan-Wigner transformation. You change your representation from Pauli operators to spinless fermions. Then you go to these domain wall type extended fermion operators. Then you Fourier transform those to get delocalized fermion operators. Anyway, to cut a long story short, you can reconstruct the effective Hamiltonian in this case explicitly. It's a bit of a mess, and it's most easily written directly in terms of these spinless fermion operators CN. But the key thing I want you to note in this is that it has non-nearest neighbor interactions. So it's CN and CN plus L, where L can be 1, 2, 3, and so on. So in this case, if we were to think of this as some sort of Hamiltonian flow, it would be an extremely unphysical one. But it's very physical because we can do it in an ion trap right now. So we have to ask the question, what sort of interesting structure does do the eigenstates of this map have, and how do they relate to the corresponding case for the Ising Hamiltonian flow and the Ising ground states? Well, the first thing you can show is that those interactions fall off very rapidly as you take the thermodynamic limit. So when I say it belongs to the same universality class as the transverse field Ising models, as you scale the system up, the weight of interactions over non-nearest neighbors dies away. So it's effectively like the transverse field Ising model in that sense. So one thing you can do is you can find that there is indeed a critical point in this system, which depends upon the coupling strength. So theta was the single qubit rotation and chi was the coupling between pairs of qubits. When theta equals plus or minus chi, there is a critical point in this system. And you can find the ground state of this so-called effective Hamiltonian, as I described before. You turn off the coupling, find the ground state, and then follow it through and look at what happens as you go through this. But in actual fact, in this system, you can do something else. You can take the effective Hamiltonian that we just derived and compute the ground state of that and compare it directly to the transverse field Ising model. And that's what we did. And if you look at derivative, the second derivative of the energy of the ground state as a function of this control parameter that controls where you are in relation to the critical point, you see, and compare it to the Ising Hamiltonian, which is the dash curve, the Ising map exhibits the same sort of phenomenon. So rather than trying to simulate something as complicated as a transverse field Ising Hamiltonian flow and find ground states thereof in an ion trap, it might be easier and just as instructive to focus on the unitary map, which is much more adapted to sequences of unitary operators. Okay, so let me conclude now. There are many other directions that one could go. One could ask questions about computability, you know, what is the complexity of the eigenstates of these unitary maps, and how does that relate to the underlying integrability or not of the corresponding classical system. We're just at the beginning of that investigation, so I'll just conclude with what I've discussed today, is that it's very easy to realize quantum dynamical bifurcations on quantum computers as an iterated map. And indeed, you can get quantum phase transitions as an iterated map. These are small-scale simulations that are available to us right now with very little resources. We can already do 8 ions. We have 1 harmonic oscillator degree of freedom and so on. And open questions would be taking the Grover example as a point of departure, can we consider interesting algorithms that might stem from thinking of dynamical maps, iterated dynamical maps? And there are indeed very interesting number theoretical properties associated with dynamical maps that people in quantum chaos have studied. And so it might be worth having a look at that. And I raised this question already about the complexity of the eigenstates. So with that, I'll conclude and happy to take more questions. Thank you. In the case of the ion telemap, 1, but you need 2 harmonic oscillator degrees of freedom. So for an ion trap, that's not so difficult, but for you, that's a bit of a challenge. For this other case, I think it would be worth trying with as few as 4. I mean, you probably need an even number. We only ever did the calculations for an even number. But 4 qubits, the simulation I gave, that was for 100. That's going to be a challenge for you. But probably of the order of 6, and I'd be, you know, really interested in chatting to you about this. With what sorts of interactions could you pull someone off with, say, a molecule with 4 or 5 qubits? Yep. Yep. That wasn't the entanglement, that was the derivative of the entanglement with respect to the coupling strength. Yeah, showing there's a, so it goes up and then saturates. So it's a sort of step. Yeah. Lee had a question. Yeah, that's something I really, really like to have a look at. There's a deep connection between so-called circular ensembles of random matrices and the eigenvalue statistics of non-integrable maps, that is, unitary maps for which the corresponding classical system is non-integrable. And there's a well-understood connection. So I think, in general terms, yes, your answer is right. That's an interesting thing to investigate. Whether you could go directly to the simulating the random ensembles, that's something I haven't really thought about, but that's worth thinking about. Yes. Both. I've only talked about eigenstates of the map here. But there's one extremely interesting dynamical phenomenon that can happen, which I didn't have time to talk about. Let's go back, for example, to this one, where we have these 2 new fixed points that are born along the line Qx equals Q, Qy. If you actually compute all the eigenstates and look at their Q functions, you'll find 2 which look virtually identical. And that's because this system has a parity symmetry in it. If you have the ground state, the next excited state looks very, very similar. It just has odd symmetry with respect to the particular transformation. Just like in a quartic potential double well, you get a ground state and the first excited state looks pretty much the same. So those 2 states look pretty much the same in terms of their phase space representation. One has odd parity and one has even parity. But if you take an initial state which is a superposition of the 2, that will be localized on one or the other of those fixed points. Now, classically, if you had a distribution of points sitting on that fixed point and iterated it, it's not going to go anywhere. It'll wiggle around a little bit, but because of something called the KEM theorem, it can't go anywhere. It can't move outside of the region of stability of the fixed point. But because the corresponding quantum system is a superposition of an odd parity and an even parity state, a relative phase will develop between the two components, and you'll go from a symmetric superposition eventually to an anti-symmetric superposition, which is in fact localized on the other fixed point. So in the quantum case, it will tunnel, in loose terms, through forbidden regions of the phase space. And that is extremely interesting from an experimental point of view. It would mean, in some cases, that you'd set it up so that classically, no matter what happened, all the particles would keep traveling to the right. But quantum mechanically, after a while, you'd suddenly see some coming back the other way. It's a phenomenon called dynamical tunneling. It's only been seen in a couple of experiments in atom optics. But here, you could see it directly in some of these ion traps. So the question of dynamics is indeed very interesting. The question of you mean the complexity of the eigenstates? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's got little to do with, I mean, there's a whole theoretical investigation unconnected with the fact that these things are easy to do in low-dimensional systems that I think is worthy of investigation. That is eigenstates of unitary operators from a sort of information theoretical point of view. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're, from my point of view, examples of iterated maps, and I was going to talk about those, but I realized I wouldn't have time. Yeah. I don't know what. One has to be very careful about the classical limit of those things, but because one has a natural tendency to call them random walks and try and look at some non deterministic classical version, but in fact, they're unitary, unless you put in decoherence. But yeah, that is another class of iterated unitary map which is of relevance in quantum information. Oh, well, there certainly are discretized versions of those quantum random walks as unitary maps. So the idea is just not worry about the continuous time version, just study the iterated unitary version in its own right. You know, there probably are things that the continuous case can tell you about the discrete case and vice versa, but there will be important differences. Just like in these systems, the Jahn-Teller Hamiltonian has a very simple bifurcation structure. It's just one simple pitchfork bifurcation structure. The Jahn-Teller map has a much richer bifurcation structure. Okay.